Iowa, check. New Hampshire, check. Brace yourself for Super Tuesday, where Texas is sure to shine. Join us. It's the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Food safety, food labels, small producers, and big producers. A roundtable with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. What's the meaning of a warrant forgiveness? How artificial intelligence is inspiring new music. What? We'll tell you more. Have you started thinking about your Valentine? Ours will melt your heart. And Mexican modern art like you've never seen it before. For real, it's been in storage for almost a century. Dust off your seat. This is the Texas Standard. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, this is the Texas Standard, our home, sweet home. Today is Wednesday, the 12th of February. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Thank you so much for spending some of your time with us. Have you heard that Washington, D.C. wants to become the 51st state? The U.S. House Oversight Committee just yesterday sent the U.S. House a proposal to make D.C. a state, which leaves me with so many questions, like where do we put the extra star on the flag, and what will this new state be called when Washington State already exists? The resolution is expected to easily clear the U.S. House, but then what? Amid those questions, we also wonder about the elections. Iowa and New Hampshire are in the books. Well, sort of. But now campaigns are setting their sights on bigger and more diverse states. Did someone say Texas over there? Yes. Once we get to Super Tuesday, do current leading Democratic candidates have what it takes to engage Black and Brown voters? Can they sell their message to the fast-growing Asian American voters? For this and more, we've invited Juan Carlos Huerta. He's a professor of political science at Texas A&M University Corpus Christi, and he joins us now. Professor Huerta, welcome to the Texas Standard.
I'm glad to be here.
So tell me, what's your take on Senator Bernie Sanders's his narrow win in New Hampshire?
Well, my take on it is, you know, this was a state where he did well in 2016. And, you know, he continued to do well there and he's had a good start on things. My main take is I think a lot of political commentators and observers are reading a lot into the results of two small unrepresentative states. And so the real test is going to be when we leave now and go to states that really are more reflective of the Democratic Party coalition.
I liked your pause. Small unrepresentative. That says so much. But let's talk about also the surprise of Senator Amy Klobuchar's performance. Were you surprised or are you still thinking small non-representative?
Well, I mean, one thing we know is that New Hampshire tends to produce some types of surprises. And so to go into an election not expecting some types of surprises is, you know, that's not the way to do it.
Okay.
But somebody's going to emerge and there's a lot of ground game going on there. There's a lot of more, personal campaigning going on there. So, you know, it's commendable for her that she had the organization in there and was able to have a strong finish. But again, it's an unrepresentative state, in my view, and the real test is going to come February 22nd.
Okay, so let's move into South Carolina. Let's move into Nevada. Let's move into Super Tuesday. I mean, what are you seeing?
Well, what I'm seeing is this is where we're really going to see who's got what it takes to prevail.
Okay.
In the Democratic Party, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans now too,
absolutely,
are becoming very vital parts of the Democratic Party coalition. And Iowa and New Hampshire were maybe 20, 30 years ago, they looked more like the Democratic Party. Today, they don't. And so when we go to Nevada and you've got a larger Latino population there, you've got your labor unions there. When you go to South Carolina and the African American contingent in the Democratic primary, that's what we're going to see who's going to emerge and really appeals to a broad base of Democrats.
And you know what? I wonder when we move into larger states, more diverse states, less white states, I wonder if we will see surprises again from people like Senator Elizabeth Warren or from Vice President Joe Biden. Do you think that they can come back?
The one I think has the best chance coming back is Joe Biden. I think, you know, we'll see him.
You don't think Elizabeth Warren, because of Texas and, you know, her coalition merging with Julian Castro and the, you know, the tour that they will be conducting in Texas, you don't see her?
Well, I think I thought Joe Biden had the highest probability of it. I think she also has a good probability, too. So, you know, political scientists, we speak in probabilistic
words. Right. We're speculating anyway, right?
So you asked me who had the best chance. I think he has the best chance. He's well known, and he has been the vice president for Barack Obama, has very strong appeal, and I would expect him to run on that and say, you know, I was there with Barack Obama. I'll be there to continue the policies that we started. Vote for me. So I think that's the real big advantage that that's an advantage he brings to the table. And I think in South Carolina, in Nevada, and in Texas and California, that can have an appeal. You're right with Elizabeth Warren. You know, she's been working in a ground game here in Texas and really trying to ramp up her support, working with Julian Castro. And so I think she also has a viable, you know, she has a path too. And that's why I think Texas is going to be so exciting in this upcoming primary election on Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday is going to be a big one. And I remember years ago, Texas went to Super Tuesday to try to have more impact, and it didn't happen. In those last few elections, Texas really is starting to have a big impact in the Democratic Party primary.
We've been speaking with Juan Carlos Huerta. He's a political science professor at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Professor Huerta, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed our visit.
Of course, no one likes getting a speeding ticket. It can totally derail your day, cost you a couple $100s, raise your insurance, and the consequences can be much more severe for people who cannot afford to pay, because courts can issue arrest warrants when people don't pay their tickets. But as Christopher Connolly of KRA North Texas reports, Fort Worth is one of several cities trying to work with drivers to get those tickets taken care of.
These days, when Ashley Bryant drives around in her black Nissan, she does it without the anxiety she carried for 6 years whenever she got behind the wheel.
Every time, you know, I do this, I pray before I get in the car. I be like, God, please cover me. Why no police won't get me today?
Bryant used to have a bit of a lead foot, she says, and by 2012, she'd racked up a half dozen tickets. She's a certified nursing assistant and simply couldn't afford to pay for them, so she ended up with an arrest warrant from the Fort Worth Municipal Court. Her license was suspended, and that made every drive to get groceries, to pick up her kids, stressful.
It's scary, you know, you gotta look behind you, make sure the police not gonna turn around and get you, because you know you're gonna go to jail because you have a warrant, you know.
Since she didn't have the $2,000 she owed, she kept driving, even though she knew she was risking arrest.
You don't want to take that road going to jail.
In 2018, Bryant's Catholic Charities caseworker told her about a new thing the city of Fort Worth was doing, a warrant forgiveness program. Basically, it's a push to get people to work with the court to resolve outstanding citations.
I wasn't going down there because I'm going to go to jail because I didn't have no money. But then when I found out it was safe through the warrants forgiveness program, you know, I took that chance and went.
There are more than 280,000 arrest warrants outstanding from Fort Worth's municipal court alone, mostly unpaid traffic tickets and some code violations and other low-level Class C misdemeanors like shoplifting. Municipal Court Chief Judge Danny Rogers says a lot of people kind of ignore tickets when they don't have the money to pay them. Others get confused.
They don't quite understand what to do. If you look at a ticket now, it's 3 pages long. People don't read that, so they don't understand. So if we can get them to come to us, talk to us, we can help them get in a situation that they can handle it.
For years, the court would participate in statewide roundups, tracking down people with outstanding warrants. But a few years ago, the court shifted strategy, launching court in the community events to help people resolve old tickets. Some fines get dropped. There's also payment plans or community service. 40,000 cases have been resolved that way.
Just come see us. We have no interest in putting someone in jail because they don't take care of their tickets. We really want people to come in and resolve their tickets.
Across the state of Texas, not taking care of tickets can get expensive fast. Depending on the city, there are fees to get on payment plans, collections fees, fees for having a warrant issued in the first place. If you don't come to court, you can get charged with failure to appear. If your driver's license is suspended, you can get tickets for driving without a license. Your car insurance rates go up, and of course, you can actually get arrested.
If at any point you have the money to pay what you owe and you just go to the court and give them the money, all of this kind of goes away.
Mary Mergler is with the advocacy group Texas Appleseed.
So clearly the people who have these warrants and license suspensions are struggling to pay because money makes these problems go away, but they just don't have the money.
Mergler praises Fort Worth Municipal Court for trying to work with people like Ashley Bryant. She's still paying off the original tickets, $25 a month. She's got her license back and has car insurance she can afford, and now...
But now I feel like I can drive in peace, you know, since I didn't take care of my business as, you know, taking care of my warrants.
Bryant knows a lot of people with warrants from unpaid tickets, and she hopes they can face their fears, head into court, and work out a plan to pay them off. In Fort Worth, I'm Christopher Connolly for the Texas Standard.
Will Stumbar is here. He is the social media editor, and he is with the Talk of Texas.
That's right, Joy. And we're hearing about last night's presidential primary in New Hampshire and Bernie Sanders' win in the crowded Democratic field. Uh-huh. Lots of comments coming in via Facebook. Yeah, Jeremy Kripe says this about the second place finisher. Pete Buttigieg has been polling poorly among minorities and is going to face a much harder fight in Nevada and South Carolina. Jeremy writes, I expect Buttigieg to drop and Biden to rise, with Bloomberg likely to start catching up on Super Tuesday. He goes on to say this means moderates will continue to split the votes and give Sanders an edge as the sole winning progressive candidate. Interesting horse race.
Did you hear the president
there
yesterday telling Bernie, they're stealing it from you again?
No, oh my gosh. Yeah, that guy.
I love that there's so much conversation back and forth.
I know. Yeah, never one to pass up an opportunity to weigh in. Meg Hertz says, I love everything Bernie stands for. However, I fear that Citizens United has created an untenable situation where Bloomberg could basically buy the nomination. He has the money, but Meg continues, he has the money and machine to return government to the people before it's too late. Quickly, Ozzie Zion Nelson, he says this about a candidate who dropped out yesterday. The media buried Andrew Yang leading up to this, but he'll be back and will be a great cabinet post.
Okay, we'll hear more. Please connect with us via Facebook, via Twitter.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Valentine's Day is Friday, but in the weeks leading up to Valentine's Day, the amount of mail coming through the small West Texas town of Valentine just skyrockets. Each February, the post office is flooded with mail from around the world, from people looking to get their love letter marked with a special stamp. And over the last 30 years or so, the art that goes into the stamps comes from artwork created by students from the local school district. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales introduces us to the student whose art is on this year's stamp.
Okay, I'm Eric Ramirez, and I'm a ninth grader in Valentine ISD.
Eric's from a big ranch family, and he lives in the nearby town of Lobo. For this year's cancellation stamp, Eric says he got inspiration from the flora and fauna of West Texas. It's a pretty common theme, but this year, Eric settled on something that hasn't been done before.
It's a quail. You know how relationships get so close, and automatically it like cuts off and it just runs away or flies away from you.
So like basically a quail.
Yeah.
Okay. Even though Eric is this year's winner, he doesn't consider himself much of a romantic.
Nor have a relationship because I'm horrible at them. So I would like someone else to have that opportunity instead of me.
So are you the quail here, Eric?
No. I'm just the ones that let them go.
When you look at the stamp, the quail is front and center. And at its feet, Eric drew XOXO in bold lettering. And like every year, the stamp reads Love Station, the unofficial nickname the Valentine Post Office picked up over the years. It's a simple design.
Oh, I thought it was cute. You know, you see quails and you're like, oh, those are cute. That's a new, something we haven't seen before.
Ismelda Ornelas is the postmaster of the Love Station.
You know, I was lucky 1 year to win it as well. And, you know, it's just fun. It's just the idea of having your art going all over around the world.
So you've won this competition too.
Yes, mine was a horse with a little flower over a fence.
The artwork from Valentine ISD students has been used as cancellation stamps for about the last 30 years. The Postal Service uses these kinds of stamps to void postage so that it's not used again. To preserve a copy of every cancellation stamp, the Valentine Post Office has an old scrapbook. It was started by a former postmaster, and the oldest one I see dates back to 1985.
So it's her little collection and, you know, notes of the countries that it went to and how much Valentine she stamped that year.
Eric, what do you think about some of these older drawings before?
To be honest, I think so they would have won.
They would have beaten me.
At its height, Ismelda says the post office received nearly 40,000 Valentines, every single one hand-stamped. But so far this year, they've received just a few thousand.
It's slowly dwindling because, you know, writing is a lost art. Not everybody writes anymore. It's email, text message. So, you know, there's some people that still write and it's, you know, nice. But yeah, it's dwindled over the years.
Although the number of letters being rerouted through the Valentine Post Office has dropped, Ismelda hopes the tradition continues as a way of spreading love and compassion.
It's something that the world needs right now, especially everything that we've seen locally in the past, 6 months, you know, unfortunately, El Paso, Midland. So the idea of spreading love is an awesome idea. And that's, you know, that's what I love about it.
Yeah. Eric, I mean, are you going to write any letters to people so you can put that stamp on there too?
I'm going to write a letter to my brother who's in prison right now. So I want him to have the stamp and the drawing I have to show how much I love him and how much I miss him so far. So, yeah.
That's beautiful.
Are you going to write a letter?
I will definitely write a letter.
You better.
I'm Carlos Morales at the Love Station in Valentine.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Do you remember those viral videos that surface of pranksters pulling off the lid of Bluebell ice creams in grocery stores? They would lick the ice cream, then put it back to unsuspected shoppers. And you can imagine that this caused a huge alarm, and it also sparked questions as to why the company, until then, had not used protective seals on their products, because protective packaging can be found on nearly everything. So, how much government intervention should there be when it comes to food safety? Well, joining us today is Mindy Brashear. She is the Deputy Undersecretary of Food Safety at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Mindy Brashear, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm a native Texan, and it's great to be back.
Well, welcome home. Let's start by just talking about what you've been working on when it comes to food safety.
Sure. As you said, I'm with the USDA, and I oversee food safety related to meat, poultry, and processed egg products. So it's a huge responsibility, and we're always thinking about public health. We, you know, don't want to see anyone get sick from the food that they eat. And so with that comes a lot of layers that we work on. We have our regulations, our policies, guidance documents for industry, and then it spans all the way to the consumer, where we have our meat and poultry hotline where they can call in and get information on how to properly handle their product.
So you're not busy at all. Let's talk about packaging now.
Sure.
When it comes to packaging, there seems to be this delicate balance between waste, because we are very conscious of the plastics that we use, the plastics that cannot be reused. But we also want our food to be safe. So how do you achieve that balance?
At USDA, we approve all of our package, all the labeling and all the packaging before it goes to market to ensure the safety of the product. Now, there are some decisions that a company is allowed to make on their own. And, you know, you have to make the decision if someone could potentially tamper with that or intentionally contaminate, and that falls into our food defense. And you don't want that to happen. I mean, that could be a significant source of illness, and we're very concerned about that as well. So we monitor that. As a regulatory agency, we can take enforcement action, try to track down where this came from in order to prevent it from happening again.
Now, let me ask you, why has this latest iteration of the Farm Bill brought the Department of Agriculture to Austin, Texas?
Well, today we are here doing a small plant roundtable. And the majority of our processing plants are small and very small processors. And the secretary, Sunny Perdue, has really encouraged us to have good customer service. And so we're here to just bring some of those small and very small processors together and for them to tell us what their needs are.
Okay.
We want to be sure to meet those needs so that they can meet the regulatory requirement and make our food products safe.
Can you tell us a little bit about the issues that have been brought about processing plants that are in your radar?
You'll hear about a recall sometimes, but it's usually about things like foreign material or mislabeled product. When we get really concerned is when we hear salmonella or listeria. And so we want to really make sure that that's not happening with these small and very small plants, because they don't necessarily have the technical resources that some of the larger companies have. And we want to help provide that information to them so that they can keep their food safe.
And I wonder, when it comes to small processors and bigger ones, are there differences in the problems that you see?
Oh, yes. You know, a smaller company may be producing more, so what they produce may have a bigger impact. And but the smaller companies may not, like I said, have the resources, and so they're going to need more assistance in making the scientific determination if the way they're processing actually kills salmonella, or if their packaging is appropriate, and all of those things. So we offer a little more hands-on help to make sure that that happens.
Mindy Brashears is the Deputy Undersecretary of Food Safety at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Advocates say lawmakers still need to do more to crack down on hazing at Texas universities. The state legislature last year passed a law to expand the legal definition of hazing and to increase transparency in reporting incidents to the public. Judson Horace heads the North American Interfraternity Conference. He told a Texas House Committee Tuesday students need to be held accountable for hazing.
And the powerful driver that the state has in its arms now, and it needs to push further, is to prosecute these students, because it will be the best deterrent for other students to deal with these bullying behaviors that happen within all kinds of organizations beyond fraternities.
Just last week, Baylor University suspended 14 baseball players for a 2019 hazing incident. Residents in Northeast Houston are demanding more testing for chemical contamination in their neighborhood. As Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports, that's after a state investigation last year confirmed higher than average cancer rates.
The state and the city have found evidence of a cancer cluster, and now the community group Impact Fifth Ward is organizing residents to insist on better data. Working with the city of Houston, they're planning to go door to door to survey their neighbors and collect information about cancer diagnoses. They're expanding on prior testing by including a 1/3 mile radius around a Union Pacific work site they say is the source of creosote contamination. Impact Fifth Ward organizer Sandra Small hopes to expand the radius even more.
Is it not just in one spot down on Lavender? Other people are dying over there, even all down to Dogen. People are dying from cancer.
Long-term exposure to creosote is associated with cancer development. A Union Pacific spokesperson said they acquired the site long after the creosote facility shut down. They say they've conducted extensive testing at the site, including soil sampling and groundwater sampling. Residents called for independent testing to be done by historically Black universities like Prairie View A&M or Texas Southern University. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
The man accused of killing 22 people and injuring dozens of others at an El Paso Walmart makes his first appearance in federal court today. KERA's Mallory Falk has more.
The 21-year-old faces 90 federal charges, including 45 hate crime charges. Police say he was targeting Mexicans in the August 3rd mass shooting and drove hundreds of miles from his Dallas suburb to carry out the attack. The Department of Justice says it has not yet decided if it will bring the death penalty. This will be the suspect's second public appearance since his arrest. He previously pleaded not guilty to a state capital murder charge.
Mallory Falk reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. When you think about a remarkable Mexican painter, who's the first person that comes to mind? Are you thinking of Frida Kahlo? Are you thinking of Diego Rivera? But do you know the work of Alfredo Ramos Martinez? Although he's not a household name, in the art world, he had a significant impact in modern Mexican art, and one of his paintings is the inspiration for the latest collection on display at the Dallas Museum of Art called Flores Mexicanas, Women in Modern Mexican Art. And it opens this Sunday at the DMA, and joining us now is the curator, Dr. Mark A. Castro. Welcome to the Texas Standard, Dr. Castro.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about this man that few people know the name. He was born in neighboring Monterrey, for instance, and he won a competition in San Antonio at the same age as my son at 9 years old. That seems to me like he was very, very talented.
He was very talented, and he spent time working in Mexico City, then spent a decade in Paris,
right.
Came back to Mexico City, and then on to the United States. So he really had a wide-ranging career.
And so when we think about this exhibit, which is gorgeous, by the way, looking at it online, but to see it, to feel it, to taste, well, not to taste it, but you know what I mean, to have the full experience in the museum. What was your inspiration? What's the piece that caught your attention?
The kind of highlight of the show is this monumental painting by Ramos Martinez. It's 9 by 12 feet, so Ooh. Very big, called Flores Mexicanas. It was kind of his crowning achievement in Mexico. It was bought by the Mexican government as a wedding present for Charles Lindbergh and his wife. And it came with the Lindberghs back to the United States and went to the Missouri History Museum, where it's sort of been in storage all of these decades.
Oh my God, that sounds sinful.
I know, it's sort of funny, these things just happen. I think through the great efforts of the staff at the Missouri History Museum, this work has come back to light after being gone for more than 90 years. And it's luscious, it's verdant, it's just a really beautiful, impressive work, and it captures all of Ramos Martinez's ability.
And what else are visitors going to see?
Well, this monumental painting inspired us to do a show that explores representations of women in the works of some of the leading Mexican modern artists, both male artists and female artists. So when you come to the show, you'll see a really rich selections of works. My particular favorite is a beautiful group of works by the painter Maria Izquierdo. Mm. She was sort of a contemporary of Frida Kahlo's. They knew each other, but I don't think they were friends. I suspect maybe there was a little bit of a frenemy relationship there. One of my favorites is a painting called The Bridal Veil, and it's almost like you're looking at kind of the scene on her vanity. There's a veil, a bouquet, some jewelry, perfume, all of these objects that we associate with femininity, but there's no woman. They've kind of been abandoned. Mm. And it's hard to look at that and not think about Izquierdo's life. She was a married mother of three, undertaking artistic training. And I suspect that created some friction. And at a certain point, she divorced her husband and took her children and decided to pursue a career in art. That's something that was unheard of in Mexico, probably a decade earlier. And she really, for me, represents the new modern woman. And I think that painting is almost a sort of self-portrait saying, you know, these are the things that I abandoned in favor of being an artist.
It is fascinating because you're right. I mean, that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why we don't see more paintings by women. So yeah. One of the things that caught my attention is the title Flores Mexicanas, because a lot of people associate flores with women, flowers with women, but flowers are sort of genderless. Everybody enjoys a flower. And was it intentional?
Yeah, I mean, I think we first took the title kind of as an inspiration from this painting, Flores Mexicanas. And I think for Ramos Martinez, you know, he definitely was conflating this idea of these beautiful, delicate flowers with notions of femininity. And the painting shows four beautiful women set in this kind of luscious landscape. But I think, you know, especially to the modern eye, you know, gender is a construct. It's made not only by one gender, but by both. And so I was very interested not only in the way women artists, and there was a great generation of women artists at this moment in Mexico, the way they were representing themselves. I was interested in how some of their male contemporaries depicted women in their work and what that may be said about larger notions of gender in Mexico.
Dr. Mark A. Castro is the Jorge Valdor Curator of Latin American Art and Curator of Flores Mexicanas, Women in Modern Mexican Art at the Dallas Museum of Art, and it will be open through September of this year. Dr. Castro, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Texas band Granite Hands has members scattered across the state, from Laredo to Denton to San Antonio. But the group recently came together and released a new record, partly inspired by artificial intelligence. Yeah, you heard it right. AI. One track from the new EP features the sound of an artificial intelligence program as it is learning. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony takes us inside the band's new EP called Void and examines the influence of AI on this new music.
One night several years ago, Sarush Ranjbar was writing and recording a song in his bedroom.
And at the same time, I was also working on my master's thesis, like on a separate window on my computer.
For his graduate thesis project, Ranjbar coded an artificial intelligence machine learning algorithm. He trained it to analyze music and compose new songs in a similar style. While running a training program for the algorithm, he was separately working on Granite Hands' music.
And while it was running, it was picking up this weird interference in my guitar pickups because I had simultaneously Ableton open.
Ableton, a recording software, inadvertently picked up the sound of the AI program as it learned. The program caused electronic interference, which flowed through his guitar and into Ableton.
And this is the sound that it was picking up.
So the cyclical thing.
Yeah, that little cyclical squeaky sound is like...
The sound ended up on the Void EP, a new release from Ranjbar's band Granite Hands. In the song It Learned, the AI gains sentience, stalks, and hurts its owner. The lyrics explore a potential dark side of machine learning and the impact it could have on humanity over the next 100 years.
Is everything going to be automated? You know, are we going to have AIs that are sentient, that can somehow be weaponized or something? I don't know.
Despite the darkness of the song, his own outlook is more optimistic.
I think for the most part, it's going to be used for good. I hope.
Granite Hands started as an instrumental solo project. Over the years, Ranjbar added other musicians from across Texas to form a full live band. Even after the band was formed, the project was still instrumental, and that previous instrumental approach makes one element of the new EP surprising. This is Granite Hands' first record to include vocals. Ranjbar and drummer Cesar de los Santos co-wrote the record and most of the lyrics. They also came up with the EP's name together.
We just threw out a bunch of words where we both had our own perspectives and meanings on the word.
For Ranjbar, void refers to the surrealness of the modern world.
The fact that we have, you know, cat cafes and like vegan ice cream, and we have, you know, geopolitical strife. I don't know, we have so much madness on this universe that we live in awesome ways and in bad ways, that in its grand complexity, it's almost like this giant void of infinite craziness.
The Void EP is out now on all streaming platforms. I'm Dominic Anthony in San Antonio.
Breathe in. Do you smell it? Love is in the air, and it smells like chocolates, flowers. Okay, teddy bears don't smell like anything, but we've been telling you that Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and there are reminders everywhere. If roses and diamond rings are not your thing, remember that the good old-fashioned love letter is not obsolete. Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong wrote one to the apple of his eye.
2 years ago, I introduced all y'all to my then 3-year-old daughter, Scarlett, my Valentine. I grew up with all boys and had only boys until she came along. She's introduced me for the first time to the wonderful world of girls. Scarlett's now 5 and I'm 65. She likes the symmetry of that. She tells people at random, I'm 5 and he's 65. I've taken to telling her that she's my favorite 5-year-old daughter. She caught on recently and said,
You're my favorite 65-year-old daughter.
The tables have turned. As with all 5-year-olds, her humor is maturing. She tells me jokes.
What do you call a fly with no wings?
I don't know. What?
A walk.
Oh, that's good. I like She's accidentally funny, too. She asked,
Dada, you go to your university so you get money for talking all the time?
Yes. Fairly accurate, actually. She also asked those Einsteinian questions.
Dada, what will happen if there was no friction in the world?
We'd have a happier planet. Here's another tough one about grammar. If mouses are mice, she asked, how come rats aren't rice? I don't know. Ask your mother.
You're funny, Dada.
That's my default response. When she got in the back of our closet and asked,
How do you have Santa's wrapping paper in the closet?
I said again, Ask your mother. Sometimes she surprises me with her spontaneous observations. She says, Did you know that if I put gobs of your shaving cream into slime, it makes it slimier? No, but certainly good to know. She surprised me also when she asked if I got a splinter when I fell down the steps and broke my leg. I said, No.
That's good because splinters really hurt.
Like all children her age, she has beautiful daydreams.
I think you should get a bicycle with two things.
Why do you want a 2-seater bicycle?
That way I could listen to the birds and you could pedal.
In her room, she has an imaginary restaurant that often has imaginary shortages. I'll order ice cream and she'll say,
I'm sorry, but the ice cream machine isn't working right now.
Just like real world restaurants. She's not so good at keeping secrets. Her mother returned from Christmas shopping, and Scarlett said immediately, I helped Dada wrap your present. It's a purple sweater from Dillard's. It's been a great year watching her grow up. She sadly had to grow up in other ways, too. I told her to put her bike away because someone might steal it. What is steal? She asked. Hated to bring that concept into her idyllic world. Mail came for her for the first time. She had never received mail ever.
Wait, look at that.
What?
You have all that mail.
I asked people to send letters. She got 15 in one day, and this is how she responded.
I got a lot of mail. I can't believe it.
I think she was happy. Scarlett has been in a romantic mood these last months. She wants her mama and me to get married again so she can be a flower girl in a violet dress. She's been drawing pictures of how she sees the ceremony, with her front and center directing everything. I like that she even gives us advice for a good marriage.
Mama, that is your husband. And Dada, Mama is your life.
My life liked that a lot. You're right, Scarlett. Mama is my life. And so are you, darling. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are wonderfully true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. You can find his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Veronica Escobar said the president has exploded the debt by more than $3 trillion, all to give billion-dollar tax cuts to the wealthiest few. Is that a fact? Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas at the Austin American Statesman is here. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to
be chatting
with you.
Let's talk about this claim.
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
Is it true?
So this was Congresswoman Veronica Escobar. She's from El Paso. She was tapped by Democratic leadership to deliver the Spanish language response to President Donald Trump's State of the Union last week.
That's right.
And she talked about a few different things that she kind of expected Trump to say. And one thing that he mentioned in his speech that she talked about were the tax cuts. And he called them our great Republican tax cuts and said they're historic and record-setting. And I believe we have audio of what she said, which is in Spanish.
El presidente ha disparado la deuda por más de 3 billones de dólares, todo por recortarle miles de millones de dólares de impuestos a los más ricos.
So what Escobar said was that the president has exploded the debt by more than $3 trillion, all to give billion-dollar tax cuts to the wealthiest few. And when she says that, I assume that she's talking about the tax cuts from 2017, the ones that President Trump signed into law.
That's right. She's talking about this Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed. This was kind of the first big legislative win Republicans yes. had under Trump's presidency. And it was a $1.5 trillion package aimed at cutting individual tax rates and tax rates for the top corporate folks. And it passed without any Democratic support.
Okay, let's talk about the first part of the claim. Congresswoman Escobar's, she's saying the president exploded the debt by more than $3 trillion. Is that part true?
So there are a couple different ways that we can actually measure the federal debt. And mm-hmm. right now, it's roughly $3 trillion under both estimates. And that's increased substantially since Trump was inaugurated in 2017. The debt held by the public has gone up by about $2.8 trillion. And then the gross federal debt rose by more than $3.3 trillion over that same period. And of course, when we're looking at what impacts that, the tax bill was definitely one of the main reasons that we saw for this increase, but it wasn't the only reason that we saw. There were two other major federal spending bills that passed under his presidency, one in 2018 and one in 2019. Mm-hmm. These bills were approved with the support of Democrats and Republicans, and together those bills increased the debt by the same amount as the tax bill did, roughly.
Okay.
So Escobar's claim is leaving out important information here, specifically that Democrats supported these other measures that also affected the debt.
Okay, let's talk about the second part of the claim. When Congresswoman Escobar says all to give billion-dollar tax cuts to the wealthiest few, what about that?
So she's right that the tax bill that we're talking about here gave tax breaks to the wealthiest people, but it also gives breaks to a lot of other mm-hmm. people as well. So an analysis that came out from the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institute found that in 2018, about 80% of taxpayers in the United States had a tax cut as a result of this new law. But when you really dig into the numbers there, you see that those figures definitely skew towards high income earners paying mm-hmm. taxes. So the center found that 21% of the total tax savings went to the highest earning 1% of all taxpayers that year, which was more than the total for the bottom 60%. And they actually projected that by 2025, the gap is going to increase there, with 25% of the savings going to the top 1%.
Whoa, okay. Okay, so what I'm hearing is I'm hearing a lot of truth. I'm hearing a lot of stuff that you're explaining to me. I wonder if you're ready to make a ruling here.
I'm ready if you are.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay,
so let's say you.
Escobar's statement is partially accurate, but she leaves out a lot of important details that could leave people with a different impression. So we rated this claim half true.
Half true. There you have it. Thank you so much for visiting with us, Madeline Meckelberg. She is with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Thank you so much for being here, Madeline.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Welcome back, Wells Dunbar. You are the social media editor for this show.
This is true.
Confirmation right there.
We got a PolitiFact ruling true on that one.
Yep.
Well, you know, you and I were talking earlier, Joy. So much to talk about with New Hampshire and Bernie Sanders' narrow win there in the Democratic presidential primary, and lots of people continuing to chime in about that one. Hopper McMahon via Facebook feeling the burn, writing, "Go Bernie."
Oh.
Enrique Lozano. There's a bit of an argument unfolding, I guess, in our Facebook page here over whether or not I guess some people arguing that Sanders is incapable of uniting the Democratic Party behind him. Interesting comment here from Enrique Lozano. He says he's not here to unite it. He's here to transform it.
Oh.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Dan Alvarez, he notes that Bernie won New Hampshire in 2016, too. What did that do for him? And a lot of
ouch.
It's interesting, you know, it's interesting
to see. They don't hold back our listeners, do they?
They really don't. And why should they?
Well, no, they shouldn't.
But it is interesting to see the sort of reaction, the expectations placed on Sanders. Mm. Back in 2016, you know, I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, he barely squeaked this out over Buttigieg. Look at how he performed in 2016. But you look back at 2016, much smaller field, not nearly as wide open.
And it's also like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, 2016.
Things have changed so rapidly. 2016,
have.
Don't use that as your measurement.
Right. And speaking of things changing rapidly, we noted this earlier in the show, Andrew Yang ending his candidacy last night.
We had him on the show.
Yeah, friend of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a great guest.
Interesting. And spoke about his, one of his big campaign planks was this universal basic income.
So you're not getting $1,000 a month?
No, unfortunately.
Well, I'm not either.
Sad. Alicia Brooks is among those folks that are sad via Facebook. She says that he was actually interesting and likable. Taylor Thomas says that he'll be back, along with a lot more like him. Taylor says that some of his policies had problems, but his ideas were valuable. And he did definitely bring something different to the field
Absolutely.
Not see.
And one of the things that I loved was how, you know, when people were complaining about the fact that he debated without a tie, he was like, seriously, is that what we're going to focus on? I have so much to say.
Not lose sight of the bigger picture, folks.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, sticking with national politics for a minute, the career prosecutors at the Justice Department that oversaw the case against Trump associate Roger Stone. Sometime Austin resident Roger Stone there. All those prosecutors have quit after the Justice Department moved to lessen the sentencing recommendation against Stone, seemingly under pressure from the president. Lots of folks chiming in on this one, as you might expect.
Yeah.
Brad Emmons writes, personally, I think the president attacking our own judiciary by name is worse behavior than trying to strong arm Ukraine's president. What's weird is that it's all so unnecessary, since there's no surer odds in Vegas than Trump's eventual pardoning of Stone.
Mm.
And it does raise a good question.
I'll tell you what, I don't know what you believe in or what you think about Roger Stone, but watch the documentary, Get Me Roger Stone. It's super interesting.
Available on Netflix,
yeah. And also, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is showing some love. He's coming to Mesquite east of Dallas for a rally on Valentine's Day. That and
this
so
Friday.
Much more on our website. And on Texas Standard, on Facebook, on Twitter. Join us and please tune again tomorrow. The Texas Standard will be waiting for you. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.